think that consumers need to get their financial house in order to protect themselves from the potential economic vulnerabilities, which I believe lie ahead.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Thanks for joining us for part two of our interview with highly respected economist and bond fund manager Lacey Hunt. If you haven't yet watched part one of our discussion with Lacey, in which he explains why a credit crunch is unfolding right now in real time that will materially cool the economy, head over to our channel at youtube.com/Wealthion and watch it there first. It sets the context for the investment themes we discuss in this video. Okay, let's get started watching part two of our interview with Dr. Lacey Hunt. One other thing that you've mentioned a couple of times, but we haven't really, I think maybe given it its full shrift here, is the fact that bank credit lending is tightening here, right? So this is a separate powerful contractionary force that is layered on top of what the Federal Reserve is doing here. So how substantial is this, and what does history tell us to expect when this happens?
Well, it is very interesting. In fact, if you look at the 12-month, 24-month, and 36-month rate of growth in bank credit, which would be loans and investments to the bank, they're all negative. What's very significant is that money or deposits lead bank credit. When the Fed throttles back on the money supply, it takes a long time before the banks choke off the lending cycle. In fact, you can see it on our charts that the 12-month change in inflation-adjusted bank credit is a lagging indicator. It doesn't become negative until you're already in the recession. In fact, there are cases where bank credit doesn't even decline in a mild recession, or it doesn't decline until the end of the recession. So the economy is still moving forward. We're not in recession. Labor markets are still gaining. But what is unusual is that the bank credit, a lagging indicator, is negative in real terms for the last 12, 24, and 36 months. That's very unusual, extremely unusual. So you have a slowdown in money and bank deposits, you have a contraction in bank credit, and you also have a high real policy rate as well.
So to hear you say it that way, I sort of think of it as like a perfect storm.
It's the fact. Monetary policy works through several channels. One is the policy rate, one is money supply, one is bank credit. In this case, they're all telling you the economy is heading toward economic deterioration.
All right, I'm going to ask you to...
And less inflation.
And less inflation, okay, great. And we'll talk about that in just a minute here, because in less inflation could mean deflation at some point. And I know that prior to the pandemic, that was the big warning bell that you were ringing. So I want to give you a chance to sort of comment on that. It's I'm going to ask you to prognosticate here, which is in terms of the manifestation of the lag effects from the policy decisions that have been implemented over the past year and a half or so, kind of what inning would you put us in terms of their expression on our lived experience? You know, do we have the vast majority of them still to come? Are we midway through the game? What do you think?
I'm not exactly sure what you're asking me, Adam. Just could you just restate the question again?
Yeah, I'm sorry. So the lag effect of policy decisions like,
oh, okay,
on the interest rate is best.
Yeah, we're very late in the game, but this is the seventh quarter since the financial the maximum point of financial looseness. The lag the longest lags are 9 months, 9 quarters. So we're very late in the game, but the lags could still persist for another 6 months or so.
Okay. And let me just ask it again, just to make sure I capture what I'm trying to say here, which is the arrival of the impact may operate on a time frame of 9 months on average, or whatever we want to think it is. But the intensity of the impact may not really, that may increase exponentially, right? We feel it very little at the beginning, but a lot at the end, right? So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is how much of the pain that you think we're going to experience from the lag effects have we experienced so far?
I would say that the pain has been pretty pronounced in the manufacturing sector, excluding automotive. There's a very material decline since last September. There's been a material impact on gross domestic income, but GDP is continuing to rise. So I would say that the economy has experienced. I would say they're beginning to feel the pressure, but we're not close to the middle innings by any chance.
Okay, and that's sort of where I'm going into this. This video is being watched by kind of regular people, and I'm trying to help them sort of understand what to expect in their own lived experiences. And if we feel that there is potentially substantial layoffs ahead, a real recession ahead, maybe something that pulls today's highly richly valued markets down as a result, you know, that's going to be a lot more pain than for sure they've felt so far this year. You know, last year wasn't a cakewalk for them, but this year, you know, a lot of people are saying, phew, I think we dodged a bullet. I think from what I hear you saying is no, you haven't.
I would say that we have not dodged a bullet. And I think that you can always get better luck. There can be fortuitous circumstances. The fact that we've had poor weather and the energy markets have righted themselves, this is really not a positive for economic activity. It's going to boost the inflation rate a little bit temporarily, but more importantly, it's going to disrupt household budgets at a time when household budgets are already in disarray.
Right. Okay. And I'm not trying to force words in your mouth, but it sounds like if I could kind of put some words in your mouth to the average consumer, it might be, now might be a good time to buckle up.
I think that is extremely sound advice. I think that there are a lot of potential risks in the economic outlook here, and it's a time for caution and carefulness.
Okay, let's conclude here by.
Let me just make one little point.
Sure.
According to the numbers that I recently saw, the average credit card loan rate is now over 20%.
It's the highest it's ever been. You're right.
Yeah, it's the highest.
Criminal.
Now, what I've said is that the household sector is either completely unaware of the matter of compound interest, or else they are in dire straits. Because when you pay a 20% interest rate for a prolonged period of time, if you can go 7 or 8 years, you're gonna pay more in interest than what you initially borrowed. I mean, this is you're really compounding your problems to be borrowing heavily at 20%. I mean, this is not a smart thing to do. And it's a time when the consumer need to be pulling back. And I believe that is happening between the banks seeing that the loan loss provisions on automobile loans and other types are rising. But I think that consumers need to get their financial house in order to protect themselves from the potential economic vulnerabilities, which I believe lie ahead.
All right. And this is why I was kind of digging in with these questions, Lacey, here, which is Before we turn the video on here, you and I were commenting on the interview I just did with behavioral economist Dan Ariely that will have run the day before this video airs. And, you know, we talk a lot about the irrational decisions that people make with money, right? We would expect them to make very rational decisions because everything's so computation. We're able to compute and it's so quantifiable.
The credit cards are a case in point. A rational person would not be paying 20%.
Exactly. They wouldn't be at all. And what may be going on here, and you have the arc of history, so I'm excited to hear your answer here, is that, you know, consumers, you change behavior one of two ways. Right. You project ahead and say, oh, if I keep doing this, this bad implication is going to happen. So let me change my behavior today. Sadly, I think it's a minority of people that do that. Most people change because the status quo just becomes so painful to continue that the pain of continuing it eventually exceeds the pain of changing. And so right now, it seems that people, you know, had a lot of help during the pandemic with the money that was mailed directly to them and the forbearance programs and the tax credits and all that stuff. And they shifted their lifestyle or their spending. And now with all that stuff in the rearview mirror, rather than downshifting their lifestyles yet, they're trying to continue it for as long as they can by putting it all on revolving credit. And that can continue only up until a point, right? And then it can't continue any further. And then you really get an injury, not just to household, you know, balance sheets and budgets themselves, but to the economy, because as you were saying earlier, you know, 70% of our GDP is consumer spending. And so my point is you tend to, it's sort of like the Hemingway things where you go broke pretty quickly at the end, right? You know, you don't see much of a change, and then all of a sudden you really do, because you just can't continue the status quo anymore. Is that sort of what we're risking here right now?
No, I think so. But that's the nature of recessions. I wrote a book in 1987 called Time to Be Rich. It was published by Macmillan. I don't know whether it made anybody else rich, but it helped me out a little bit. And what I basically talked about is the five stages of the business cycle. And people, and this is the way I would describe it. An expansion has three phases: revival, acceleration, and maturation. Revival is when you come out of a recession. Acceleration is the nice part of the middle part of the curve, when the inflation rate is still coming down a little bit or stabilizing, but the real economic indicators are accelerating.
That's the boom everybody loves. Yep.
That's what we all live for. And then there's maturation, and inflation starts accelerating and the real growth rate turns sideways. The recession has two phases. The first is called ease off, in which the economy begins to decline, but it's not really clear that it's declining until long after the fact. And in fact, the most concrete that I can say about maturation and ease off is that the statistics look almost identical. The lagging indicators remain the strongest component in both maturation and ease off. The leading indicators are deteriorating, and the coincident indicators are mixed. So what do we have now? Well, you have some of the components of the economy declining, like industrial production, gross domestic income, the Chicago Fed's National Activity Index, and so forth. But the overall economy is continuing to grow. But the second phase of the recession is called plunge. I call it plunge. And the economy just breaks, and you have a waterfall. And so we often go through a process in which people will say the recession is not coming, that this time is different, because the initial impact of the inflation and the monetary response don't seem to congeal, but ultimately they do. So okay. Plunge comes after ease off, and that's what we haven't seen yet.
Okay, and it feels like we're right on that cusp right now.
I think we're moving there. And this upturn in the commodity prices and the cost of basic necessities, which we may see in June, in July, and maybe perhaps in August, if this commodity surge does not continue, if it continues, then that will add to the problems. It does not solve the problems.
Okay. And I wonder to score this because, you know, if we're looking at headlines, right, we're seeing a lot of headlines of, hey, the most expected recession in the world never happened, and maybe we dodged that bullet. And using just sort of Wealthion as a data set, I would say in the past couple of weeks, month or so, you know, we've seen a surge in comments of people saying, hey, all these people that were on your channel that were kind of, you know, advising caution of what lay ahead, you know, later this year, you know, those guys are all wrong, right? You guys have missed the mark. You know, we're in this great new rally, and you guys have just been way too bearish. And look, I can't ignore what the markets have done. The markets have had a pretty, you know, vicious start to the year so far, first half of the year. But it does not seem like from a macro standpoint that we are out of the woods. And what you're providing here is, you know, both the academic economic explanation for what to expect, but also just your understanding of history, where you've said, look, this is kind of what we expect to see. We see these sort of declarations of a false dawn right before we get to your waterfall.
Well, I'm not a stock market investor, and I don't venture there with my opinion, but I personally do not believe the stock market is a good indicator. I know there's a wide variety of people believe the stock market is the economy. But the fact of the matter is, at the last critical turning points, the stock market provided no warning, or only the barest of warnings, maybe of a few weeks or very limited. Take the Great Depression of 1929. The recession, the Great Depression started in September. The stock market did not buckle until October of 29. The stock market, there may be a wealth effect, but it only applies to a very small percentage of our people. The vast majority of our people do not have a sufficient holding in the stock market to be a benefit to them. It is true that we can look at the screens and see whether it's red or green, but it doesn't mean that whether it's green or red, that is pointing to where the economy is heading. And we have to look to these economic indicators. And I think that there are a lot of people that would like to presume that red versus green is all I need to know. Well, no, that's not the way, and it has not worked out that way historically, and particularly so in the last 20 or 30 years. The stock market has not been a leading indicator. And it, to me, it's not an important, that's why I don't discuss it as an economic indicator.
All right. Well, these are my words, not yours, but from what I hear you saying is yeah, the stock market really can be sort of the wily coyote at economic turning points, where it can walk in midair for a while after the economy has plunged, and deceiving people because it's still hovering there in midair. But eventually it has to catch up to what the economy is doing.
I just don't think it's a good indicator. I would not be guided by it. That'd be my recommendation to your viewers.
All right. Well, let's begin to wrap this up. Thank you for giving us so much of your time. And this has been again, just another fantastic discussion, Lacy.
My pleasure.
We've really been light on charts, and I'm going to talk in a moment about our upcoming conference in the fall. But when you give your presentations, your keynotes at our conferences, and you walk through all the supporting data of the charts to what we're talking about here, like I said, it's literally like a graduate level presentation you offer. But you don't, and I understand why you don't talk much about stock market and make predictions about it and whatnot. But you do manage a bond fund. And so you have to pay a lot of attention to what's happening in the bond world. And I believe at Hoisington, you mostly specialize in treasuries.
We are only investors in treasuries.
Okay. So, from your vantage point as a fund manager, where do you see treasury yields heading in the future?
We believe that the trend is downward, and we believe we have a long duration, and, our long duration product does have a gain for this year. We had a loss last year. We're not happy with, but we believe, in spite of the mixed nature of the economy, we believe the critical forward elements the ones that will ultimately determine, indicate that a long duration portfolio is warranted. Another thing that I might add, we haven't talked about it, is that we have a very highly inverted yield curve.
Mm-hmm.
The short rates are on top of the long. Well, by the way, when you have an inverted yield curve, and we've had it now for more than a year, an extremely long time, there were times in the last 4 to 6 weeks in which the spread between the 2-year and the 10-year was more positive than any time since the 1980s. Well, the inverted yield curve serves to reinforce the decline in money supply, bank credit, and the consequences of high real policy rate. Because not only the banks, but the non-bank entities, the shadow banks, they make a profit by borrowing short and lending long. They can't do that when the yield curve is inverted. But the other thing that investors should be aware of is that these inversions of the yield curve, particularly those that have been extreme, and this is now an extreme inversion, have typically preceded a very substantial reduction in long-term yields.
Is there a direct relationship between the extremity of the inversion and the extremity of the decline in yields?
It's you have to weigh all the factors. There's no single shot explanation, but it's present in very important periods of declining. In other words, the inverted yield curve, the longer and steeper that the inversion is, it generally tends to coincide with significant declines, although there have been a few cases where the declines were only modest. But it hinges heavily on what are the initial conditions. And in this particular case, as I've cited to you before, I do not believe the initial conditions are favorably either domestically or globally.
Okay. And this is not individual investment advice for anybody watching this, but I'm just curious, from your tenure as a bond fund manager focusing on U.S. Treasuries, I would think that this may be a particularly attractive period to be investing in, or at least considering investing in Treasuries, for two reasons. One, they're finally paying you something again, right? So you're getting a nice return. It's actually a real return now,
it
which hasn't returned a real return in a long time. And you know better than I on that. And you have, while you're waiting to see how this plays out, you're getting paid. But if yields actually come down and you're in long duration Treasuries right now, A, you're getting paid, and B, there's that optionality that you will realize as the price rises, as yields in the marketplace come down.
This is just a theoretical computation, not a promise of anything, but if the long Treasury yields in the 30-year come down 100 basis points, then you would have a total return of 20% in addition to the coupon. So there you go.
Right. So sitting in a safe instrument and getting a coupon. So I don't really want to put words in your mouth, but is from the arc of your career investing in U.S. Treasuries, is this a year you're perhaps more excited to be investing in?
There was an instance when I was more excited was in 1981, when I was at the Fidelity Bank in Philadelphia, and we were able to purchase the long Treasuries close to 15%.
Yeah. And then you had a wonderful tailwind behind you for the next 40 years.
We did.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, Lacey, I can't thank you. We've gone way over time. Thank you. I know we're going to get a lot of strong support in the comments for this. So, in wrapping up, I just want to let folks know about two things. One is that, again, a reminder that you will be the keynote speaker at Wealthion's upcoming conference in October. It's Saturday, November 21st, if I'm remembering the date right. Secondly, as I said earlier, we will make this quarterly letter of Lacey's available at wealthion.com/Lacey. You can download it for free or go to Lacey's website, read it there, and see all the other resources that he has at that very excellent website. Lacey, thanks so much. Really appreciate this.
Great questions, Adam. All the best to you.
All right. We'll see you in October. All right. Well, now's the time of the program where we bring in the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, one of the endorsed financial advisory firms by Wealthion, to react to what Lacey just said in this interview, as well as update us on what's been going on in the markets over the past week. I'm joined this week by John Lodra. His partner, Mike Preston, has the week off. John, great to see you. What were some of your key takeaways from the discussion with Lacey?
Hello, Adam. Great to be with you again, and always a treat to hear Lacey and his decades of balanced wisdom be shared with us. Really enjoy his talk. Lacey, I think, did a very good job at helping us dive beneath the surface of a lot of headline news flashes that can be taken out of context. For example, he talked about how if you look at the recent GDP numbers at 2.5%, I think, a full about 2% of that 2.5%, 80%, in other words, was attributable to very strong activity in the automobile sector, which in his surmising was basically the last sector to really catch up from the COVID slowdown. And we've already seen the auto sector start to hit the skids a bit with car prices coming down and inventories going up. So just one of the very many nuanced beneath the surface data points he helped us pull out. He did talk about, we've seen an economy that's trucking along here, but when you look beneath the surface, like, for example, he referred to the Chicago Fed National Activity Index. There's something like 80 different components there. And in June, only 30 of those components were advancing. The rest were declining. So there's to paraphrase, there's a beneath the surface, there's a narrowing of the economic advancing. And that typically is very typical of an economy that's starting to slow down and see some trouble on the horizon. And it's frankly, it's not unlike what we see in stock markets when they get exuberant. We see, and this has been the headline of this year, and frankly, every really major bubble top market almost always is defined by a narrowing of the leadership of just a handful of typically story stocks, meme stocks, whatever you want to call them, owning most of the index advance. And underneath the surface, you have a broader deterioration of stocks and sectors. Now, we have seen, as we've talked about, a broadening of the stock market advance since about June, early mid-June, but still very heavily concentrated in just a handful of stocks. Lacey did also talk about his, similar to what some of your other guests have talked about, the lagged nature of how monetary and financial conditions transmit through the economy. And he talked about a financial cycle leading a business cycle, which then ultimately goes into a price and labor cycle. He pins late fourth quarter of 2021 as probably this cycle's top in the financial cycle. And it's not surprising that's when the recent all-time highs were achieved in stock markets, to be seen if we take those out with recent advances and near-term direction of the stock market. But from there, he, I think, nicely pointed out that no one cycle is always the same. So as much as we want to pinpoint, what is the lag, typical lag? There's inherently a range to that because of the way that nuances are different every cycle. But he said pretty robustly that typically you see about a 7 to 9 quarter lag between a financial cycle peaking and the business cycle peaking. And that would put us right now in the seventh quarter. So we're right in the zone for what, we and many of your guests, and certainly Lacey is amongst those, right in the zone for a lagged kind of timing for us to see real market slowdowns in some area, key areas of the economy, right in this quarter, fourth quarter of this year and early into next year. So all those things kind of line up with a lot of the things we've been saying, and the inherent imprecision of timing these lags means that sometimes calls can be early and positionings can be early, but he talked about the credit cycle starting to show some real slowdowns. The money supply has been falling off a cliff. I just saw latest chart of M2. You know, I think the pace of decline is going back to like 1933, the last time we've seen that level of deceleration in M2 money supply. But that invariably leads a slowdown in credit creation and credit extension. Banks have and lenders and both traditional banks and shadow banks off mainstream sources of credit have started to pull in their horns. We've seen a contraction in credit, and that flows through to things in the broader economy. So really interesting talk from him, and he is the first to say he's not a market tactician. He's more of an economic. And he, I think, shares what we share, that the market oftentimes is a very, very poor indicator of what's going on in the real economy. And absolutely, we think this market is absolutely untethered from certainly from a valuation standpoint to the true health of the underlying economy and the durability of the advance we've seen this year in markets. So I'll stop there, Adam. I'm sure we got plenty of jump off points from there.
Yeah, no, great summarization. And Lacy, you know, I sort of look as Lacy as like a master mechanic, right? Like, so he doesn't get, like you said, he doesn't really spend a lot of time looking at the markets because he doesn't think they're a good indicator, as he said several times. But what he does is take the analogy with the car. You don't really get distracted by what models are popular right now or what the new fad color is. He's popping up the hood. He's looking in the engine and he's saying, okay, look, I can tell you specifically what's going on right here. And he is one of the most experienced and respected economists alive today. And, you know, he just looks at all the data. He's not slinging opinion. You know, he's really digging into the economic data and saying, look, this is what I see. And, you know, in his own words, he said, look, I think we're going into a credit crunch here, right? So, you know, what I valued from the conversation was there's been a lot of pushback, I think, from the what I'll call sort of the casual investor, who was very happy with the highly Fed interventionary time period following the global financial crisis, where for over 10 years, they could just kind of ride the market, right? You could just go long, you could buy the dips, and you were doing great. And it was pretty easy, and everybody got real comfortable with that, right? And you didn't really have to pay attention to what the markets were doing, except just to kind of embrace the sentiment that, you know, everything's awesome. Then 2022 arrived, and it forced people to have to care and to have to start paying attention to how they were allocated, right? And some of them were kind of dragged kicking and screaming to have to kind of resume that type of responsibility for their investing allocations. And then lo and behold, you know, 2023 starts, the markets catch fire by Q2. And everybody is hoping to be able to go back to the way that things were. And they're saying, hey, you macro guys that are talking about all these concerns, you guys just don't get it. You know, we've made it through the storm and the sun's out and everything's going to be great from here. Lag effect, what lag effect are you talking about? It's you know, now been a year and a half since the Fed started hiking interest rates and everything's getting good again, right? So there's this sense that people want to just sort of, you know, wrap the comfort of what they enjoyed, you know, in the post GFC decade around themselves. And understandably, you know, they're looking at what the markets are doing and saying, hey, look, there's a lot of money to be made here. And those of you that are, you know, pointing out warning signs, you're missing the boat and you're going to miss the party, right? And I can't deny what the markets are doing. And absolutely, there's been money to be made in this market, and probably there still will be for some time here. But I think what I heard Lacy say is, guys, this is a false promise. Looking at the data here, the lag effect is absolutely going to express itself here. And if you just dig a little bit below the headline numbers, just like if you get a car with a new fancy paint job, but you pop open the hood and actually look on what's going on, you can see that there's a lot of things that aren't working well and are likely to get worse from here, right? So it was very validating, I think, of the folks that watch the macro data and saying, look, yes, we should be really concerned about this data, and there are shoes that are going to drop. The only other thing I want to add to that is I watched recently an interview that Jeremy Grantham gave with David Rosenberg, Really good discussion. And just a quick note for folks, I used to write summary notes of these interviews on Wealthion. We're just doing so many, and you know, with growing the business and running the business, I just haven't had the capacity to do that going forward or up in, you know, in this year. I'm hoping to be able to bring that back at some point. But I did spend some time sitting down and writing up my notes to this Grantham interview with David Rosenberg. And I'm making that available on my Substack, which is something that I'm just playing around with right now. So if you're interested in reading those notes of that interview, go to Substack, just type in my name. You should find it that way. But what Grantham said, John, is you know, he is a study of the market, a student of the markets. And he said that, you know, we have had several great bubbles in history, one of which we are potentially seeing bursting right now. He believes so. And he says you have to analyze those very differently from all the other regular bull market cycles because they're so distinct. And if you look at the burstings of them, they all tend to follow a very similar pattern where you see the most speculative assets get hit the most first. And that's what we saw in 2022 with all the high flying growth stocks. But then you see kind of a recovery, usually in January of the next year, as all the tax loss sellings occurred and all the proceeds are then looking around and saying, oh, well, we now have these bargain values in these former darlings. Well, let's put money back into them. And they shoot up again. So what Grantham is seeing, and to a large extent to what Lacey is seeing, is yes, we have this sort of like what they would call sort of a false summer right now in terms of the markets and sentiment and whatnot. But they're saying we would expect to see this at this stage. And what we expect to see coming next from the progression of history that these very seasoned investors have seen several times is you then start to see all these other shoes start to drop, oftentimes catching the people who all flooded back into the market by complete surprise because they thought the storm was ending, but when it was actually really just beginning to get underway. So you've been nodding a bit as I've been saying this, John, but I'd love to hear your comments on it.
Yeah, I know exactly the interview you speak of there, Adam. I listened to it, I think it was several weeks ago, but I may be off on the timing, but it was fabulous. I mean, Jeremy Grantham and David Rosenberg are both multi-decade sages of market cycles. And one of the key points you teased out there that Jeremy Grantham makes is that there are, you know, the vast majority of financial market history, you can kind of lumped together as kind of normal times, right? Yeah, they're going to go through cycles, ups and downs, but they're kind of relatively homogenous from a data standpoint and a behavior standpoint. But every once in a while, and very rare, you get these super bubbles and frankly, super sell-offs. And those two episodes are very rare. The super bubbles, the super overvaluations are very rare. I forget what percentage of financial market history you said, maybe 5% or 10%, some small number. And you can't lump those in, as history will be your teacher. You can't lump those in and make the same kind of conclusions or takeaways as other times in market cycles. And the same thing can be sold to his credit. He makes the point he's not a perma bear. In fact, he's one of the very few people that called many of the major bubble tops, but also was very pounding the table of, hey, now's the time to be buying, like he was in late 08, early 09, after the housing bust. But the reason I bring this up is if you look at the market action this year, first of all, it's been a market that up until the last month or so has been defined by a small handful of stocks. We talked about this ad nauseum over in conversations with you and other guests you've had, you know, 7-8 stocks, the Magnificent Seven. If you look at through about the beginning of June, take those 7 stocks, they were all the gains in the S&P 500. The rest of the 493 were actually flat to, I think, a little down on the year up. And since that time, we've had a broadening out of sorts. So it's not just those stocks, but it's still very much the bulk of the gains have been concentrated in these very small handful of stocks. But this is a market that has gone higher almost exclusively on what we call multiple expansion, not an increase in earnings. In fact, earnings, you know, numbers and estimates were reduced going into the second quarter. So you had a complete rally basically this year on multiple expansion. And the layperson's interpretation of that is the expensive just got more expensive. It's not like things suddenly became undervalued and deserved to be bid up and priced to a more fair value. quite simply, the expensive got more expensive. And that is all well and good, but if you don't have the economic follow through to justify that, which even if we did have some, you know, plodding along here, we're still at multiples and valuations that are parallel, you know, only been seen a few times in history on objective measures. But the problem with this is we're seeing a lot of momentum headlines and FOMO headlines. Like, for example, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is coming off, I forget how many days of straight days of gains, daily gains. And it was like the longest streak in maybe history or in 50 years or some rare event. It's only been like two or three other times in all of financial history. And yet, such a small sample size of those few times in history that's happened. And there's folks out there saying, well, in the other two times this has happened, next 6 months later was always the market was always higher. Well, first of all, that's not a very big data sample to you know, from the standpoint we sit managing clients' hard-earned retirement money to be wagering a big bet of one's hard-earned savings on, you know, well, it happened twice before in history, so maybe this third time is going to happen again. But it also pays no recognition as to valuation levels and other really important data points comparing this current time versus the other time. So a lot of careless, frankly, headline grabbing stuff that misses the point that Grantham makes, that there are times where you cannot compare other periods of financial market history because they're just so out there on the extremes. And comparisons to prior episodes of this or that just aren't even apples to apples. They're complete apples and oranges.
All right. Well, look, you know, I think it's super important to be listening to these greats of investing who have seen so many market cycles and seen more of these extreme elements that you were talking about, these moments that you were talking about, John, which are a small slice of the market. And so many just sort of average armchair investors just kind of assume the same playbook's gonna work, where oftentimes it doesn't, because these things are very distinct. So anyways, go watch that interview, read my notes on Substack if you want to get the key takeaways. Back to what we talked about with Lacey here. Lacey did a great job of, it's funny, I used this term in the interview I just did with Dan Ariely about behavioral economics. But he did a great job of making the invisible visible here, right? Like, you know, pulling up the data and showing us what's going on with money supply, with bank lending, with real rates, with productivity, all of which have massive implications. And it's probably worth talking about productivity for a second here, because, you know, in Lacey's words, he's like, that's pretty much the whole ball of wax. You got to look at where productivity is going, and productivity has been weakening substantially. And in Lacey's words, it's like there's really only one way at this point that you can fix that is you have to, I can't remember the exact term he used, maybe it was rationalize the workforce, which is economists speak for layoffs, right? You basically got to bring the cost of your workforce into better alignment with its volume of production. I was talking, you know, with Lacey in the interview about like, okay, well, you know, what does that mean for real people? And what type of, you know, future are we seeing here? And he said, look, you know, you're going to see a pretty bad recession, right? He said, he also made the comment that periods of extreme inflation generally beget periods of extreme recession, right? So these are important developments or shoes that are likely to drop in the future. These are developments that are likely to come out of the progression that we're seeing here. And I just want to flag too that, you know, Lacey is telling us this, but this is exactly what we've heard from cycles folks like Lakshman Atuchin, Michael Kantrowitz and his HOPE framework, Eric Basmajian, who has a riff off of that, where, you know, they look at the leading indicators, they look at the coincident indicators, they look at the lagging indicators, and you can see them sort of rippling through time, right, where the leading indicators have cratered, even in employment, but the coincident and the lagging ones to a certain extent are taking longer as you would expect them to, but it doesn't mean they're not going to fall in the same direction. It's just the progression for how these things work, right? So, you know, when I asked Lacey about do you see recession and layoffs as basically inevitable at this point, my interpretation of his answer was, yeah, I mean, I really do. So again, I'm not trying to give people the impression this is all going to happen tomorrow. we're going to wake up and the market's going to be down some massive amount overnight. But what I am saying is we do seem to be, if you look at the headlines, you definitely seem to be in danger of convincing yourself that the future is going to be less risky and rosier than what these very smart experts are telling us it is likely to be, based upon both historical precedent and what the data is telling them as it's unfolding right now. So, I'm not telling people necessarily don't be long, but I'm saying if you are long, you really should have a plan in place for why you're long and what you're going to do if indeed some of the things that Lacey talked about confidently is likely to happen in the future do start happening. And this is the world that you live in, John. So you got to help people navigate this on a, you know, that's what you do for a living.
Yeah, absolutely. And here's the thing. We are in a momentum driven market, which, we investment advisors, market strategists can bury people a lot of, you know, sophisticated sounding terms, but momentum is a really powerful thing in markets. Sometimes though, it deserves to be called what it should be called. There's a point where momentum becomes FOMO and performance chasing. And if you go back to the major psychological faux pas of investors and investment advisors and managers for that matter, it's chasing performance late in a move higher and selling out of fear and panic at the bottoms. So there's real important nuance here. Momentum in a market that's at more reasonable valuations, yeah, that's a tool to encourage folks to put a bit more of their chips into a stock posture. But when we're at valuations and extremities and narrowness like we've seen now, our feeling is that's a pretty large wager to be making for, you know, money that people, our clients, don't get a do-over. This is money that is all the money they're ever going to get, more or less. They've sacrificed their during their working years to save and forego instant gratification so that they can have a secure future. And to use a, you know, thing like a momentum indicator as if it were a foolproof blessing to overstay a very extended market, there is huge context there that is got to be taken into account. So we're, you know, nothing wrong with following momentum, but position sizing is really important. You know, moving 10% into a momentum driven, strategy is a whole lot different than moving 100% or 70% or 60%. The consequences could be dramatically different depending on what happens and where we are in the cycle. And to your Lacey's comment about, the economic reconciliation by companies. We're already starting to see it. I mean, I saw today over my screen flash the quarterly revenue growth, year-over-year quarterly revenue growth of Robert Half, which is a behemoth staffing company. They do temporary placements of professional and other staffing. And, you know, typically in a normal business cycle, companies will obviously hire permanent employees to right-size their workforce for the business that they have and expect. But they'll, around the fringes, optimize their workforce by taking on temporary workers, you know, be it a computer programmer for a 9-month deployment that rather than hire someone full-time, you get, you know, a very skilled computer programmer to come in and through a temp agency like Robert Half. Quarter over year over year quarterly revenue growth has fallen off a cliff. It's negative for the first two quarters of this year. The only other times in the last 15, almost 20 years that I see in this chart was during the COVID meltdown and the 2008-2009. So we're starting to see it. Companies are starting to rationalize the simple areas first, saying, hey, no more temp placements. We're having a hard time rationalizing our permanent workforce. So absolutely, I think there's the high likelihood of follow through to weakening in the jobs. And in fact, as a lagging indicator, if you go back and look at almost every recession, the jobs numbers actually look pretty good at the beginning of a recession.
They do.
In hindsight. And they actually tend to bottom. They look their worst when recessions are bottoming, coming out. So it's a very, and I think David tried to put a time frame on, you know, that you got the financial cycle, you got the business cycle, and then you got the labor and price cycle. I think he said the labor and price cycle typically lags the business cycle about 1 to 2 quarters. So that would put later this year into the first half of last year, maybe where we'll see the most prominent impacts if there's going to be some in the labor market. So really, these are the things that move slowly through the economy, and you can't help but just to point to the massive amounts of distortions that understandably are going to have some weird effects on these things playing out like they should in theory, right? The one other thing I wanted to mention is to your point about people that we work with. I mean, it's ultimately, it comes back to their lives. I can tell you almost categorically, most clients are going to be the biggest risk they have is not waiting for the last bit of juice in an overvalued market. The biggest risk they're going to have is suffering a decline that takes off years of, if not decades of their financial security. And definitely the with valuations where they are and the extents of the markets, there's definitely a skew to the longer term downside than upside in our very strong opinion based upon the data.
Yeah. And based on that, again, we're not telling people not to go long here, right? But we're telling people, if you do, have a plan in place for if it turns out that we are late in the cycle of this kind of relief rally here, whatever you want to call this rally that we've seen so far in 2023. And it's also worth noting too, John, you've made this comment many times on this channel, but Jeremy Grantham made this comment too, pointedly in his interview, which is that, in some of these mega busts that we've seen from these great bubbles, those busts have been punctuated by some of the biggest rallies that we've ever seen on record, rallies of 20, 30, 40% or whatnot. As the bust is happening, these rallies are happening, as it's going on. So again, they sort of provide false hope, and they get people who've been sitting on the sidelines, back in, or people who, thought the worst was over, start, increasing their long exposure. And then the bear comes back in with its claws to drag everything down further. Again, not saying that that's definitely going to happen here, but saying that very smart people see precedent for this and see the patterns that are playing out right now to be very similar to what we've seen in the past. Hey, John, we definitely should just note while we're talking here that about an hour before we hopped on here, the Fed announced that it indeed was doing another quarter point rate hike, 25 basis point rate hike, which was expected. In the comments following that, Powell is saying, hey, we still are likely going to hike again here, folks. So I just want to say that if you listen to the preponderance of what Lacey said, of all the things that are weighing on the economy right now, the Fed is still ratcheting up the pain, if you will, right? It's still ratcheting up the force of gravity that it's trying to pull the economic growth down with in order to keep inflation under control. So it's kind of like, yeah, everything Lacey just said, but even more going forward. And there's two other things I want to mention on that. One is there's what the central banks are doing, of course, and then there's what the banks themselves are doing. They're tightening their lending standards, and this is on top of what the central banks are doing. So, Powell has been very clear in warning that, like, hey, I'm doing all this stuff. But the on top of that, the tightening that the banks are doing, those substitute as additional rate hikes for what we as the Fed, might be doing. So be aware, folks, that all this stuff is pulling down gravitationally economic growth. And that's why Powell himself has been talking a lot about the lag effect. So it's not just us, it's the policymakers themselves. But Lacey, in his recent article, he points out what is historically aberrant about the tightening we're seeing right now. He says, in previous cycles, real bank credit did not turn negative on a one-year basis until the economy was already in recession. Even in the global financial crisis recession, the 12-month change in real bank credit did not decrease until the end of the recession. He then says, but the latest 12, 24, and 36 months rate of change in real bank credit are all negative. He says, as the second quarter ended, the contraction in bank credit showed the markings of an old-fashioned credit crunch. So, what Lacey is saying is we're seeing bank credit tightening so much right now that it actually is beginning to create a credit crunch. Of course, credit really is the whole enchilada in terms of how the economy goes. And when the credit markets start to have issues, that's when the economy really starts to have big issues. And he's basically just saying, we're seeing a worse deterioration of credit conditions right now, even before we necessarily enter recession, than we saw in the past big recession. So that's a massive warning flag. I'll let you comment on that, but I'll mention one more thing just so you can react to it too, if you like, which is one of the things that I wish I'd had a chance to talk with Lacey about, but I just didn't see the data until after we'd recorded, was you would think with debt rates, you know, rates on debt, interest rates going up as extremely and as swiftly as they have, that would start increasing interest expense at corporations, and that would start depressing corporate margins. But instead, we've seen the opposite so far, and that's been a real head scratcher. But the answer, the explanation for that is that companies, you know, and it makes sense, when rates were super low, they levered up and got as much cheap debt as they could. So they're still basically servicing that cheap debt that they have on the books, right? At the same time, since yields have really increased, they've taken their corporate cash and they've stored that in treasuries and, you know, other short-term facilities that are now giving them a new and much greater return on their cash. So they're kind of winning on both ends. They're paying low interest expense and they're getting more cash interest getting paid back to them, right? Which is great. The problem is that's all temporary, right? As time goes on, more and more of those corporations are going to have to go out and refinance, and their interest rates are going to re-rate in most cases, probably around two times as high, right? Twice as high as what they were paying. So this is one of those things where people are like, yeah, the lag effect, what lag effect? Like everything's going fine. This is sort of an artificial, you know, benefit, little window of benefit that these companies are getting. But unavoidably, that debt is going to have to reprice, and that is going to really whack corporate margins, right? So we know empirically that that's coming, but it's one of those things you have to just sort of dig a little bit under the hood to really understand what's going on here. So, you know, we've got this issue of this unfolding potential credit crunch, and we have things like these re-ratings that are just going to make it, you know, substantially worse going forward. So you've been nodding as I've been saying all this, John, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is to Lacey's point. He said every cycle has its unique differences. And one difference in this one, it has been the massive driving down of interest rates and the massive leveraging up by corporations at those low interest rates. And it's all well and good until that debt comes due. And the two options are either to refinance at whatever the prevailing interest rates are, probably quite a bit higher than where that debt was taken out, or pay it down, which is a big sucking sound of all that corporate liquidity. You know, many investment strategists have always touted, oh, cash on the balance sheet, or maybe, you know, even more pointedly, over the last several years, corporate stock buybacks have been all the rage. You know, great when you have free cash to do that, but if you got to divert that cash to paying down debt that's ready to mature at much higher interest rates, you know, say goodbye to that. Even though we haven't even seen that wave of debt maturity come due, because there was a massive amount of corporate debt issued at those low rates, we're seeing a notable uptick in corporate bankruptcies. There's been a pretty sharp rise in corporate bankruptcies, and this is even before, you know, the real credit crunch has happened. Just saw today a headline about the healthcare sector, for example, now that they're off the life support, excuse the pun, of COVID stimulus to respond to the COVID emergency. Healthcare bankruptcy, healthcare company bankruptcies are spiking higher. So these are all things that are playing out kind of before our eyes and really haven't made it into the markets yet. One of the things I like about Lacey is he's very schooled in all the deep economic thought, but he also brings just some real practical observations. Like, so for example, we can debate all day long about corporate profit margins and earnings estimates. What we do know is that quarterly earnings are oftentimes a circus show because CFOs and, you know, financial accounting gimmicks can make earnings reports look better or worse, usually better than the reality really holds in a longer term sense. But you know, look at a real data point, and you pointed this out, and I think you have, Adam, too. You look at the actual tax receipts by the Treasury. You know, the tax receipts on earnings have gone down. So either companies are, you know, playing games and avoiding taxes, which, you know, they certainly do plenty of that. But, you know, the earnings seem to be dropping off a cliff, or the net earnings anyways. And that's a real data point. Look at a couple of other, you know, he didn't mention this, but, you know, look at a couple sectors that have gone gangbusters this year. The semiconductor sector has gone gangbusters higher, stock prices. Yet you can look at semiconductor chip inventories. They've gone through the roof, meaning there's all this dead inventory that's not getting sold. I think you have to go back to like the housing bust, I think, or maybe even tech bubble, to see similar kinds of spikes in inventory. So here you have a hot sector, but you know, all this activity is just showing up in inventory. Same thing with the consumer. You know, consumer discretionary sector has been one of the hottest sectors this year. Yet you've got retail sales dropping off a cliff. You got, you know, even just on the ground indicators like cardboard box shipments. You know, most things that people consume today is not walking into a retail store, but going on Amazon and getting a cardboard box shipped to you, and they've fallen off a cliff. So you can sometimes get lost in the lingo and the data, you know, promulgations of folks like us. But if you just look at the readings on the street, that oftentimes gives you a pretty good clue as to what's really going on, despite all the hand waving.
That's a great point. And again, this is one of those situations where the headline numbers can be deceiving. So like a lot of, you know, gross retail sales, GDP, stuff like that, it's influenced by the price inflation that we've seen over the past 2 years, because it's reported in dollars, right? I don't have the chart handy here, but there's a chart I saw recently that showed retail sales on a unit basis. And those have been in pretty sharp decline, right? Which basically is just showing that, okay, people are buying fewer things. Now, the overall retail sales numbers aren't coming down as much because they're factoring in the price inflation. People are just paying higher prices for fewer things, and so the number's not changing quite as much. But if you look at just on a unit basis, the slowdown is really pretty sharp. And we've seen a number of warnings this year issued by companies in the logistics space that are in the business of just shipping real things, you know, to real places from point A to point B. We've had warnings from FedEx. We've had warnings from UPS, you know, other big international shippers in the U.S. here. This week, I think we're seeing the bankruptcy, looks like, of Yellow, which is a short haul trucking company. And yes, they've got some issues with their unions and whatnot that are kind of complicating the situation. But a big issue is that they were unable to meet some of their pension payments because they're just not making enough money, right? So we, to your point, when we're really looking at kind of the practical indicators, they're telling us a pretty clear story here. All right. Well, look, we got to wrap things up here in the interest of time. Thanks so much for another great week here, John. Folks, a couple quick resources for you. One, a reminder that much of the discussion with Lacey was based upon the Q2 letter that he wrote to Hoisington's investors. He's very generously made that letter available to the general public. And so if you'd like to get a copy on it and read it yourself, just go to wealthion.com/Lacey. You can read it there for free. Secondly, as we say every week, you know, everything that Lacey told us about just basically said, look, you should have a plan going forward for managing your portfolio here, particularly if you're going to be invested long in assets. And we just highly recommend, as we normally do, that the vast majority of people watching this program should do that, working under the guidance and with the partnership of a professional financial advisor who's good, number one, but also who really does take into account all the issues that Lacey talked about here. If you've got a good one who's doing that for you, putting together a personalized portfolio plan for you, and then implementing it for you while keeping you well informed, absolutely stick with them. They are pretty much priceless. But if you don't have one, or if you'd like a second opinion from one who does, maybe even John and his team there at New Harbor Financial, then consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the financial advisors that Wealthion endorses. To do that, just go fill out the short form at wealthion.com. These consultations are free. They don't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with these advisors. It's just a public service they offer to help as many people position themselves as prudently as possible before the additional shoes that Lacey thinks may happen start falling. All right, John. With that, thanks so much for hanging with me for yet another week. Look forward to seeing you next week. I'll let you have the last word here. Any parting bits of advice for folks, especially given all of the folks that you guys talk to every day over at New Harbor with their concerns about the current market environment?
Yeah, thank you, Adam. And thank you, folks, for listening and watching. We have the opportunity to talk to a lot of people, many of whom do become clients, but our conversations aren't about sales. They're about consultations with real people about their real lives. We talk about markets, but invariably the focus of the conversation is about the specifics of each individual or couple or family that we talk to. So it oftentimes, obviously we'll have questions about markets, but it's really bringing back to their, could be a someone that's approaching retirement and they want to know what their options are for their pension plan, and they maybe can take a lump sum or this or that, or should I take Social Security? We go through the math and analyze things that really relate to their situation. So, we find that if we just try to have an objective conversation, if there's a good fit and folks feel that we can add value, then we're privileged oftentimes to have those folks become our clients. But it's never a sales call for us. It's just us trying to share our perspective, our insights, and the rest takes care of itself.
All right, John, thanks so much. And just to, again, underscore your message there, who knows what the future is going to bring, but there's the old saying that the best time to patch your roof is when the sun is shining. While we have this moment in the markets where everything feels great, and we're not entirely sure how long it's going to last, this is the right time to be having all of those types of discussions with John. The first one being, hey, how's my portfolio positioned if things start getting rockier from here in the future? But once that discussion's been held, then just go through all the other things that John was talking about, just the real life money events, money needs. How's my retirement planning coming along? If I've got a plan for college for my kids, how's that going? If I've got to take care of an aging parent, am I resourced to do that? I mean, just all the things that you guys talk day in and day out with your clients there. All right. Well, look, in wrapping up here, folks, if you've enjoyed this interview, if you'd like to see Lacey come back on the channel, if you enjoy these weekly updates and check-ins with John and his team there at New Harbor, please do us a favor, support this channel by hitting the like button and clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. John, thanks so much, buddy. Look forward to seeing you next week. Everyone else, thanks so much for watching.
Thank you, Adam. Always a pleasure, and we'll see you next week.
If you'd like to schedule a consultation with one of the financial advisors at New Harbor Financial, simply go to wealthion.com. These consultations are completely free and there are no strings attached. The good folks at New Harbor will simply answer any questions you have about your investment goals or your portfolio and give you their best advice given their latest market outlook. They're willing to do this because they care about protecting people's wealth and because Wealthion has connected them with so many thoughtful investors just like you over the past decade. We started doing this because so many people have approached us in frustration, looking for a solution because they're feeling out of alignment or downright ridiculed by the standard financial advisors who have been managing their money. You know the type. The kind that just pushes all of your money into the market, scoffs at the idea of owning gold, and when you bring up concerns about the market's sky-high valuations, they say, "Don't worry, the market will always take care of you." For many of the reasons discussed in today's video, we think this is one of the most challenging and treacherous times in history for investing. We strongly believe that today's investors are best served working in partnership with a conscientious professional financial advisor who understands the risks in play. Now, we're agnostic which professional advisor you work with, as long as they're good. If you're already working with one, that's fantastic. Stick with them. But if you don't, or are having trouble finding one you respect or trust, then consider talking to John and Mike and the team at New Harbor. Now, for those about to ask, yes, there's a business relationship between Wealthion and New Harbor, which we've put in place to make sure everything is handled according to SEC regulations. All the details on this are clearly provided on the Wealthion.com website. Also, it's important to note that New Harbor is able to work with U.S. citizens, green card holders, and those with existing assets in the USA. But for regulatory reasons, they aren't able to take on non-US clients. All right, with all that said, if you'd like some insight and guidance on how to protect your wealth during this unprecedented time in the markets, go to wealthion.com
to schedule your free consultation with the good folks at New Harbor. Thanks for watching.